Okay, good afternoon, hello, and welcome to this first ever National Interactive Town Hall conference call on solutions to the very high and outrageous cost of college. You'll have a chance to ask a number of questions, and you'll have a chance to participate and weigh in on surveys, as we hear from our expert panelists today. So, good afternoon. My name is Greg Narag. I will be your host and your moderator for today's discussion. It's brought to you, by the way, by Alumni to the Rescue. This is a conversation about the higher education bubble. So what is that? College costs continue to rise. Students and parents incur massive debts in order to pay for something that, you know, really they see as a necessity, a college education. And they assume that they'll be able to pay that college education off once their graduate son or daughter starts their career. Yet, you know what, it's hard to find a good job nowadays, or in some cases, any job at all. And so what happens? They're stuck is what happens. They're saddled with a mountain of debt, a mountain of student loans that are now more than a trillion dollars in the United States today. And that debt limits their future. It limits the economic activity that we really all rely on to fuel our nation's future. And that hurts not just the individual student and her family, it really hurts all of us. And people are starting to wonder then about not just the cost of a college degree, but also its quality. So a lot of you have probably heard about this. That's nothing new, but we're not here to rehash bad news. The folks who have organized this event are a number of concerned alumni, and they come from a number of organizations, a Better Colgate, Andrew Hamilton Institute, also the Society for the College of William and Mary, and the American Council of Trustees and Alumni. You can learn more about all of those groups and our group altogether at www.alumnitotherescue.com. Check out that website, alumnitotherescue.com. So why don't we get going? Let's go ahead and talk about those solutions. Today we have a panel of three very outstanding experts in various facets of higher education for some blunt discussion. But before we get into that, let's give you some quick instructions about how you can get involved and be a part of this call. If you have a question or a comment for our panel any time during this conversation, we really want to hear from you, so go ahead and join us. You do that by pressing zero at any time, and a friendly person will take your question, and they'll ask your first name, your alma mater, and your year of graduation. So again, that's zero to ask a question. If you'd like to give us your contact information so we can keep you in the loop about our efforts, about what we're doing, we can do that too. Press 7 at any time. So again, to reiterate, that's zero if you want to ask a question, and 7 to leave your contact information. We're also going to have a replay of this discussion that you can listen to anytime on the alumnitotherescue.com website. We've also started a Facebook page. We'd like you to check that out if you're a Facebook member. Go ahead and like us on the Alumni to the Rescue site at Facebook. Now let's go ahead and introduce our distinguished panelists, and we're very excited about all three of them. We begin with Dr. Richard Vedder. He's an expert in education economics. He's the Emeritus Professor of Economics at Ohio University. He's an adjunct scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and the director of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. Want to make sure I got that right. Dr. Vedder, good afternoon. Welcome to you, sir.
Glad to be with you, Greg.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Vedder. We'll get to you in a quick moment. We want to introduce as well Ann Neal. She's the president of the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, better known as ACTA. Now, their mission since 1995, and I'm going to go ahead and read from their mission statement because I think it's quite a good one. It is to support liberal arts education, uphold high academic standards, safeguard the free exchange of ideas on campus, and I think most importantly here, ensure that the next generation receives a philosophically rich, high-quality college education at an affordable price. Ms. Neal, welcome. Good afternoon to you.
Thanks, Greg.
And rounding out our panel today from our nation's capital is Dr. Robert Kranach. a long time and really very popular professor of political science at Colgate University. Dr. Krainak is also the director of the Center for Freedom and Western Civilization at Colgate. And Professor Krainak is currently in Washington today, leading one of Colgate's study groups this semester. Dr. Krainak, how are you? Good afternoon, sir.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I look forward to your questions.
Okay, thanks. So let's go ahead and get started. We've got a lot to talk about today. And my first question goes to Dr. Vetter because, sir, you've done quite a bit of work and research. You've got an excellent book, Going Broke by Degree. And in that book, you explain why college costs so much. So that's the top of the discussion here. So why does college cost so much? What do people need to know that maybe they don't know?
Well, I wrote a 240-page book about it, and I can't explain it all in a minute. But basically, colleges raise their costs because they can get away with it. Remember, the people going to college often are having their way paid for, at least temporarily, by others, the federal government and student loan programs, by philanthropic people who are contributing to scholarship funds and the like. And so students aren't as sensitive to prices of colleges as perhaps consumers in other parts of the economy. And so colleges feel they can raise their cost, their tuition fees to cover whatever financial needs the colleges perceive to have. And also, the colleges have very, very few incentives to cut costs because there are customers out there who are willing to fill the seats at the school. So why bother? They often ask themselves.
Okay, outstanding. And we're going to get into a little more detail on all of that. Just a reminder to anybody listening out there, if you would like to get involved in this conversation, please do. We invite you to do so. Press zero at any time to ask a question. And if you'd like to leave your contact information for us, if you're interested in these issues and want to know more, hit number 7 to leave your contact information. We'd like to get to one of our other panelists, Ann Neal. So, Ann, Dr. Vetter pretty much teed it up. College costs a great deal, and there's specific reasons for that, and we'll talk in a bit about how we can maybe turn that around. But so, college costs a lot. It's ever-increasing. Now, your mission statement talks about ensuring a high-quality education. Are we at least, are kids at least getting that, the quality education? What would your answer be to that?
Well, that's really the question. What are our students getting for all this money? And regrettably, there's substantial and mounting data that our colleges and universities are really suffering from low academic standards all the while they're raising their price. Recent surveys show that employers say they can't find the college graduates with the skills they need in today's workforce. The Department of Education's own national assessment of adult literacy found that college graduates had difficulty comparing two editorials or even computing the costs of office goods. And our own survey, whatwillthelearn.com, and I urge our listeners to go to our website, looked at more than 1,000 colleges and universities across the country to see what they expect their graduates to know in terms of general education, key areas of knowledge such as math, science, foreign language, writing, composition. And what we found is that most schools today, even though they promise a strong core curriculum, are allowing their graduates to leave without having exposure to these key subjects. 20%, only 20% across the country require their graduates to study a survey of American history or government. Only 5% expect them to study economics at a time of great global competition. So regrettably, Greg, the answer is our colleges and universities could be doing a lot better than they're doing at the price they're charging.
Okay, Ann, thank you for that. So there you go. So we've got high college costs and regrettably, it looks like maybe not that great a product or what you're paying for. Let me bring in Dr. Krainak from Colgate. So, sir, you've been at Colgate, by my count, I think 35 years, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the new millennium. You've been there quite a bit. You've seen a lot of students come and go. You've seen a lot of action at Colgate. Talk about Colgate for a moment. It costs almost $58,000 a year at this point. with respect to what Dr. Vedder just said and Ann Neal, as far as Colgate's concerned, what has your experience been there as a faculty member for that long a period of time? Are students getting the bang for their buck? What's your viewpoint on what's happening at Colgate?
Yes, I have been at Colgate for 34 years, and I've noticed several big changes over those 34 years. Some of them have been positive, but I believe most of them have been negative. So we are now paying more for, I believe, a lower quality education. Let me just mention three areas where there have been major changes: the faculty, the administration, and the job markets. If we look at the change in the faculty over the last 30 years or more, we see that it has changed dramatically. The 1960s radicals who challenged the establishment have now become the tenured radicals. We see an emphasis on political indoctrination, replacing the liberal arts great books program, and in a way, even what we call critical thinking has been replaced by the ideology of race, class, and gender. This has gone along with an increased specialization in which many of the big questions of life are being diminished in favor of narrow subjects. So the quality of education as it comes through the faculty, I believe, has changed quite a bit in the last 30 years. The second big change is in the administration. We've seen a huge growth in academic administration. I think it's a lot like the federal government. It's out of control. The expansion of an administrative bureaucracy, spending on new programs and new offices, in which we have more and more deans, counselors, diversity officers, sustainability officers, communications officers, wellness institutes, an associate provost for equity and diversity, a special assistant for community building and outreach. Some of this is necessary, but much of it is unnecessary. What seems to drive the administrations are a combination of, I call it PR and PC, public relations and political correctness. So we're overregulated and over-budgeted. The third big change is in the job markets, the relationship between the university and the job market, which was touched upon. Why are people willing to pay so much? And here we get into the role of the university in training our graduates for their future professions, and the way in which many people feel that we're locked into a prestige system of the middle and upper middle class and now international students, which wants the credential. And so people are willing to continue to pay for education, which they may have reservations about, and which could be cut back, but in fact they feel as if it's an absolutely necessary credential for their future careers. So all of these trends that I would like to talk about as we move along in the question and answer period, I believe have given us the feeling that we're paying more for less quality.
Okay, and Dr. Greenock, thank you for that. You've certainly set up a number of topics I'd like to get into here as we do discuss that, and certainly we'll bring Dr. Vedder and Ann Neal in as well, because I'm sure they're chomping at the bit to weigh in on a lot of that as well. Hey, just want to remind everybody, we see a number of people have joined us. If you would like to get involved in this conversation, this is intended to be an interactive conversation. We do want to hear from you. So go ahead and get your way in here. How you do that is dial 0 at any point, 0, to ask a question. One of our call screeners will line you up, ask your name, your alma mater, your year, and we'll jump you in here and have you ask the panel a question. If you're interested in these topics, you want to hear more about them and possibly get involved with us or learn more about what Alumni to the Rescue is up to, dial 7 at any point to leave your contact information. Remember our Facebook page as well. Go to Facebook, find us at Alumni to the Rescue. Quickly, we also want to mention alumnitotherescue.com. One of our listeners asked us to repeat the website, alumnitotherescue.com. We promised we'd ask you a few survey questions to let you weigh in and participate and give us your opinion. We're going to do that right now with question number 1. We have a survey question about the cost of a 4-year private degree. So listen to this, and we're going to ask you a question here shortly. Today, the cost of a 4-year college degree at either Colgate University, Hamilton College, or Yale, 3 universities we looked at, is right now, if you didn't know, hovering around $232,000. Now, that's almost a quarter of a million dollars. Our survey question, though, is about the average cost of a four-year private college degree, which is now at about $169,000. $169,000. Is that too much? Press 1 right now if you think $169,000 is actually a reasonable price. We want you to press number 2 if you think $169,000 is too expensive. We have a third option. Press number 3 if you think the reputation of your school and the field of study justifies any amount. So again, press number 1 if you think $169,000 is a reasonable price. Press 2 if you think that's too expensive. And press 3 if you think the reputation of the school and the field of study really justifies any amount that you can pay. So go ahead, hit those numbers. We're already seeing results now. In a few moments, we'll give you the results of that. We'll maybe have our panel weigh in on what people are thinking. What I'd like to do is turn to our panel. So we pretty much established the problem: high costs, questionable quality. We talked about some of the possible reasons why that is. Well, we promised this would be solutions-oriented talk. And so let me ask a big open-ended question of our panel. Where do we go from here? How do we turn this around? I guess what we're looking for here is reasonable, practical solutions, things we can do today to maybe start reversing this trend, or at least getting the attention of trustees, getting the attention of administrations, and letting them know this is really not acceptable. We really would like to see something happen. So let me turn to Dr. Vetter. Sir, what is your view as far as what possibly could practically be done? And as I ask Dr. Vetter that, I'll let him answer, and if the other panelists want to jump in, feel free.
Well, I've always said that there are three magic words beginning with I that are the key to reforming higher education. One of them is information. Alumni, students, other people interested in colleges have to know what's going on in the colleges. They have to know where the problems are. They have to know where the waste is, where the inefficiencies are. And there's a lot of lack of transparency in the higher education community. Often boards of trustees of universities do not really have full information, much less alumni and parents. A second thing we need are incentives. And this is very important. In the private sector, for-profit private sector, incentives are there galore to make firms be innovative, to cut costs, and so forth. If you cut costs, you increase the profits, you increase the price of stocks, you increase salaries and bonuses for workers. We need to do something that may be not exactly that, but something to incentivize people within the higher education community to behave more responsibly, put in better curricula, teach students more, and do it more efficiently at a lower cost. And lastly, this leads to innovation. Innovation are new technologies, new ways of doing things. And higher education has been perhaps laggard in some respects in using innovation and new technologies in order to reduce costs. I think if we have the incentives in place and the information available, I think the innovations will follow. So these are just sort of broad concepts rather than specifics. We could talk about how we could cut the administrative costs of universities by 25 or 50%, and they would operate pretty much the same as they are now. We could talk about a lot of specifics, utilizing buildings year-round rather than 4 days a week, 8 or 9 months a year. But this will be a start to that conversation.
Right, right. Thanks, Dr. Vetter. I want to do this. We have a number of people lined up already looking to ask questions. We'd like to bring in a caller right now. We have Stephen. Looks like he was at Syracuse and DePaul. Is Stephen here? A class of 1976. Stephen, welcome to the call. We'd like to get you in here. How are you today?
Real good, and pleasantly surprised by a midday call of relevance and not some solicitation.
Well, go right ahead. We're happy you think it's relevant. Opinion.
Yes. Well, I commend you for this great, great conference, and I'm glad to be a part. But to get to the chase, I appreciate what the two gentlemen preceding me said I agree completely, but I want to just turn the problem a little on its head. You know, I don't think it takes much to get the attention of the middle class and above on the ideas of lowering the cost of education. That's an important subject for most people, you know, concerned in our country about their own household, you know, economies. But
right.
More important to me is the societal problem. Basically, in a nutshell, the problem is the inflation of the worth of a college degree, or I should say the necessity of a college degree, by politicians for their own interests, for the interests of institutions and their friends and donors or whatever the reasons may be. I think that is the single most pernicious effect of this present inflation of college education, which is causing such a redirection of necessary funds away from what I might think would be more valuable spending, such as secondary school training, apprentice training. We've all heard these ideas from Europe. This is nothing new. But I think the lead factor in the continuing problem and the coming debt crisis, which I've been reading about, of college debt, is how do we get the attention of politicians and say, hey, look, we all like college education. In a great, in an ideal world, every child should benefit from it. But in a world of limited circumstances and resources, is this the best way to spend on our youth, or should we look at other ways of realizing their futures, again, through apprentice training and channeling some of these dear dollars?
Okay.
We have more colleges than any country.
Okay, Stephen, thanks for the call. We just wanted to get the flavor of your question there. And Neil, you were listening there. What's your reaction? And what's your
Well, sir, it's certainly a very good question, and I think actually we can look at the President of the United States, who in his State of the Union address talked about his concerns about affordability and performance. So I think there's a growing awareness that we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars for higher education, and in too many places it's going down a rat hole. So I think you're absolutely right that we have to find ways to reward value, and we have to make available to students a range of options, whether it's vocational training or liberal arts education. And I think what we're also seeing is a growing concern by parents that their students find a good job, and that makes a lot of sense. But I think it also gets back to the broader question of preparing graduates, whether they're at a vocational school, a community college, or a four-year liberal arts college, with a strong foundation of skills and knowledge that will prepare them for success after graduation. These days, the Bureau of Labor Statistics points out that between the age of 18 and 45, one is apt to have, on average, 11 jobs. And so it's very important to have that foundation of math, science, and basic skills, which, as we've discovered, in too many places is not being offered. And this gets back to what Dr. Vetter was saying in terms of information. I think it's very important for more information to be out for parents, which is, again, why the American Council of Trustees and Alumni has put together its What Will They Learn ratings, to show families what colleges expect their graduates to study and what price they are charging and whether or not students graduate in less than 6 years. And so you can find real value at very low costs, such as the University of Science and Arts of Oklahoma, a small public liberal arts college that for just under $4,000 in-state tuition can provide you a very strong foundational set of learning and really prepare that student for success after graduation.
So the three panelists, a quick follow-up question. Do you think parents in your experience have done that? Have they been good at finding out what colleges are supposed to be teaching their kids, or is this something that they haven't really thought about? They just plunk the money down and get their kids there and hope for the best?
This is Bob Kranak from Colgate. No, I think they rely way too much on U.S. News and World Report, what I call the prestige system of the middle and upper middle class. And we have to break out of that mold of just relying on the rankings in U.S. News and World Report. We have to be aware, like Ann was saying, of these other colleges which have excellent education and, like our caller said, vocational training. But I also want to add another point, too, which I half agree with our caller. That is the business world, not just the political world. People in business have to be willing to hire people who have practical experience without necessarily a college degree. We used to respect something in America called the School of Hard Knocks. Whether you worked your way up just through jobs or had military experience or started your own business, that was considered as an important credential, as well as a college degree. So we have to crack the entire prestige system, both in the rankings of the schools, but also the way businesses and in the political world look at what we mean by education. It means much more than just having a degree from a prestigious university.
Okay. Remember to our listeners, we have a number in queue here, and we have a number of calls we'll get to. If you have a question for the panel or a comment, a reaction, you'd like to challenge them, anything at all, we'd like to hear from you. If you're on the line now, go ahead and dial 00 to ask a question. We'll get you lined up, or we'll get you in there. We also have some survey questions we've been asking. Before we get to our next call, we want to repeat our survey question and actually tell you the results. We asked you if $169,000, which is the current average cost of a four-year private college degree, we asked you if $169,000 is too much. Well, we have our results. Option number one, $169,000 is a reasonable price. 26% of our respondents said, yeah, that's about right. $169K is fine. Option number two, $169,000 too expensive. 65% of our respondents say, yeah, that's too expensive. And then 10% are telling us that, well, it really depends on the reputation of the school and the field of study. To any of our panelists, Dr. Vedder, does that surprise you?
No, it doesn't at all. I think there's a growing feeling that the costs are getting out of hand in relation to capacity to pay, in relation to what is delivered. And remember, there's a growing evidence that a lot of people are graduating from college these days and ending up driving taxi cabs, serving as bartenders. There's 115,000 janitors in the United States with bachelor's degrees. And as this sorts of information gets out, people are going to ask and are asking, is $169,000 really worth it? Is it too much? And so it doesn't surprise me that 65% of your survey respondents felt that way.
Okay.
Greg, this is Ann. I noticed that the Inside Higher Ed was recently talking about a new poll it did of parents of high school age students. And more than a third of the parents of high school age students said it was very likely that they would restrict the colleges their children applied to on the basis of cost. 70% said it was very or somewhat likely. So I think we're seeing what Dr. Vedder is saying, Dr. Krainak is saying, that parents and taxpayers are saying we've had enough and we are going to try to find value. And so it's important for alumni to promote schools that offer a quality education at an affordable cost. And it's critical that trustees engage these issues of cost and quality on their campuses to make certain that higher ed is accessible to everyone.
Okay. Thanks, Ann. We want to bring in a couple more callers. We have Fred calling from Colgate, class of 1958. Fred, are you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead with your question.
The question was the question about the core curriculum at Colgate. Is that still in place? And is the taking of mathematics and science, is it required to graduate? I have a broader question, though, too, that I can ask.
Okay, let's start with that. Dr. Krainak, you're the Colgate professor here. How would you respond to that?
The answer is yes and no. The core curriculum is still in place. It now consists of 5 courses, so it's been expanded by 1. And my view of it is that while it still emphasizes the classics of Western thought and also opens us up to non-Western thought, that it has become watered down. And it has become caught up in something of the fashionable idea, which is called global engagements, which is a kind of a sort of watered-down version of multiculturalism. So the core curriculum is still there. It's a somewhat watered-down, more politically correct version. There is also still a distribution requirement in which you have to take a course in math and science and various areas. So that's still there in some form at Colgate, correct.
Okay. We want to move on to a couple of other issues here. We definitely want to start drilling down into solutions, but first of all, we did promise you a number of survey questions. We want to go ahead with survey question number two because we're very interested in hearing from all of you out there and getting your reactions. So here's our survey question, and remember, in a moment here, you can get involved and tell us what you think. We want to ask you a question about your level of confidence that your school, whether it's Colgate, Hamilton, Yale, wherever you are, wherever you're listening from, your level of confidence that your school can or will cut costs. So on a scale of 1 to 4, where 1 is a great deal of confidence, 2 is some confidence, 3 is limited confidence, and 4 is you have no confidence at all, please rank your level of confidence that the trustees at your school can or will cut costs. So again, go ahead and dial number 1 right now if you have a great deal of confidence that they will or can do that. Number 2, if you have some confidence they can get that done. Dial 3 if you have limited confidence and some skepticism. And dial 4 if you've got no confidence at all that your trustees are going to do that. We'll report back with results here in a few moments. We already see people pushing away, and we're seeing some interesting results right away. We'll get to that in a moment. But we want to turn to solutions. This was billed as a discussion on specific concrete solutions. So I want to open up to the panel and go a little bit deeper on where we do go from here. And we have a number of people we've spoken to in the past several months and years about alumni involvement. There seems to be a sense that maybe alumni are the best positioned at this point in time to really take up that fight and challenge trustees, challenge administrations at different colleges, and take that fight to them. Is that something that, to our panelists, you see as a realistic possibility? Are there any other groups that can really take that challenge to the university or the college level?
Hey, Greg, this is Ann. I'll take that one on as head of the American Council of Trustees and Alumni. You can imagine that we do, in fact, believe that alumni and trustees are really the critical constituencies that can help refocus colleges and universities on quality and cost. I think, as Professor Charles Anderson said some time ago, alumni and trustees who are a subset of alumni are members of the Guild. They've been educated by our colleges and universities. They're able to provide helpful insights, and they're able to stand up for high standards and deplore the politicization of education when that happens. So I couldn't say more strongly that concerned and engaged alumni can inform trustees about the issues they care about, and they can help really promote a change from the outside, because I think whether it's Casey Johnson and Stu Taylor or Donald Kagan or Harry Lewis or even Derek Bach, all of these folks are in agreement that change in terms of quality and cost not likely to start on the inside. It's likely to come from the outside by engaged trustees and alumni pushing for academic standards, demanding lower costs, and a more coherent curriculum for our students.
Okay, and Ann, thank you. Thank you for that. I'm going to go ahead and use that as a quick commercial announcement here. If what Ann just said interests you in that gets you going, we want to let you know that there are people that are making the effort to try to make this happen. If you're out there and you're thinking to yourself, wow, that's interesting, I'd like to hear more about that, a couple things. Dial 7 to leave us your contact information. We'll definitely get back to you. Or if you'd like to go to our website, www.alumnitotherescue.com, we've got some mechanisms there set up so that if you'd like us to get back in touch with you and maybe hear more about what Ann is doing or Dr. Vetter or Dr. Kranach, we can definitely get back to you with some more information. Speaking of Dr. Vetter, sir, I've known you for a while, and I've read your stuff, and I'm really impressed with a lot of your work. I'd like to really hit you over the head with a tough question, if you don't mind. We've had people come to us and ask us this question, and they pose it as a bit of a challenge to us. I'd really like to hear your take on this. What would you say when a college or university tells you, hey, we've got 8 students in line who are willing to pay the full cost, and yeah, we know we have a lot of kids needing financial aid, but we've got foreign students, we've got people that are willing to pay that price, whatever price we name, they want their kids in that school, they'll pay for it. So what are the problems that schools incur when so many alumni, so many students are foreign students coming in willing to pay? What would you say to people who say, we have people, should we just assume that private colleges are only meant to serve the financial elite, those who can pay for it?
Well, this is a very, very serious problem, and it's growing very rapidly. It's interesting that applications at the state schools of mediocre or average quality or even fairly good quality are having stagnation in enrollments right now after all the 18 to 22-year-old pool of applicants is relatively flat at the moment. But the elite colleges are finding their applications rising dramatically, partly because employers are starting to realize that not all college graduates are equal, not all college educations are equal, not all colleges have the same quality. Therefore, Harvard could charge $200,000 a year of every person that attends and raise the money. Now, they would pay a price, and part of it would show up in such things as the U.S. News rankings as becoming less selective, because at a price of $200,000, they wouldn't have as many applicants. So there is a problem there, and the colleges, because of the credentialing value of colleges having taken on almost mythic proportions, there are people that are willing to pay for college like drug addicts are willing to pay for drugs, and that makes it very, very difficult to fashion a solution. And I don't have an easy answer to it. Now, one thing we could do is pull some of the resources away that colleges are exploiting that enables them to raise prices a lot. Perhaps we need to revisit federal student loan and grant policies, particularly for middle and upper income students, for example. Why should the federal government be making loans to people with $100,000 income when it can't even pay its own bills? I could go on, but I think I've taken up my allotted time.
Okay. No, that's fine. We appreciate that. And, yeah, there's no quick, easy answers or fixes, so we appreciate that. Let's get to another caller. We have Doug Wilson calling in from Colgate, class of 1957. Doug, welcome to you. What's your question for the panel today?
Well, I had about a dozen of them, but I'll limit to one that's most germane to the subject. I'm really asking if I'm right or wrong about this. It seems to me that there is a vast amount of federal funding from the federal government that goes into higher education these days. And one would think that if the people of the country, through the federal government, are sending money to higher education entities, then the cost of education should be being diminished. And instead, it seems to be expanding. And so the money that the people, through the federal government, are putting into higher education doesn't seem to be making it easier for people to get into college and afford it. Are your thoughts on that? Am I off base?
If I may respond, Greg.
Vedder, that's you, sir? Yes?
Yeah, Richard Vedder.
Sure.
The caller is right on. The federal monies have not reduced the cost of college. If anything, they've expanded the cost of college. Because what colleges now look at it this way. They see students, no matter what their financial condition, will somehow or other find the money to pay the cost. So the colleges say, well, we can raise the cost. We can raise the price. The customer isn't too sensitive because there's someone else out there who's going to lend them the money. Bill Bennett made that comment in 1987 when he was Secretary of Education. He was right then. I think it's right now. Now, there's some other dimensions to it, too. But here's a fact. A smaller percentage of college graduates today come from the bottom quartile, the bottom 25% of the income distribution, than was true in 1970, before we had these massive federal student programs.
Okay, and thanks for that answer. We wanted to let you know about the results of our second survey question, and just to refresh your memories, that question was a question of confidence. On a scale of 1 to 4, we asked you to rank your level of confidence that the trustees at your institution can or will cut costs. So here were the results. Option number 1, I've got a great deal of confidence that my trustees will do that, 4%. Some confidence that our trustees will be able to cut costs or are willing to do it, 12%. Limited confidence that our trustees can get that job done jumps up to 35%, and perhaps not surprisingly to our panel, 49% of our respondents say, I have no confidence whatsoever that our trustees can or will cut costs. Dr. Krainak, any surprise there?
Not really, but let me focus on perhaps some ways in which they could be. I'll give you the example of Belmont Abbey College in North Carolina. They have a courageous administration which promised a tuition freeze. It seems to me that if we had more courageous administrators, they could make statements like that. We are going to make a blanket tuition freeze. I think we also have to think more carefully about the whole question of accountability. I think this, to me, is the biggest way of thinking about the solution. How do we demand accountability from the universities? It doesn't work the same way as the government because universities are not a democracy. The way in which it's going to have to develop is through our own set of checks and balances, and I agree completely with the view that the alumni will be a key factor in those checks and balances. But courageous administrators, a new way of thinking about what an academic administrator is, that is to say, you can build your resume as an academic administrator not just by showing how many new buildings you built and how much more money you spent, but how you are a prudent manager of scarce resources. Why can't we create incentives for that producing honor and glory in one's resume? So let's think about all of the ways in which accountability and incentives for administrators and alumni can move us in the right direction.
Greg, this is Ann. If I could add in here, I think that we are already seeing trustees taking on the challenge and starting to address costs in effective ways. We've seen Sewanee cut costs. We've seen the University of Maine, after public attention was drawn to its ever-rising tuition, the board there chose to cut tuition not once but 2 years in a row. We've seen trustees at Temple cut tuition. As you heard, Belmont, we've seen. Florida, we're looking there at a system of governors which is working hard to keep tuition affordable. So I think we are already seeing trustees take on these challenges because, quite frankly, the taxpayer and families have really had enough. And I would urge people to look at the state report cards that the American Council of Trustees and Alumni has on our website, which are really designed to let trustees and others see what is the increase in tuition vis-a-vis median household income. Are the schools using their buildings effectively? It's amazing to see how few schools today are basically open and doing business on Mondays and Fridays. And this is something, again, that has major consequences. When we hear about binge drinking, when we hear about substance abuse on campus, I think we can point our fingers at the administrators and the faculty who are allowing these days to go essentially unused for academic matters. So these, again, are things that trustees can increasingly look at and that are going to be able to reduce costs.
Okay. Thanks for that, Ann. By the way, I just wanted to jump in here. Something interesting is going on during the course of this call. We wondered what kind of response we would get here today, and we just want to give you a taste of what's going on, who we're seeing jumping in. We've had nearly 1,700 people jump in and listen to this phone call this just in this past 40 minutes that we've been on. And lest you think this is only a discussion about Colgate, since we have a Colgate professor and have some Colgate callers, we actually have people, alumni here, waiting in queue and who are listening from the following schools, just to give you a little flavor. Colgate, Georgetown, DePaul, UCLA, Syracuse, Hamilton, William & Mary, Yale, Southern Connecticut State, Hardin College, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Just a little taste of who's on the line right now listening to this. So, folks, got a lot of interest in it. It seems like we've struck a nerve here. And speaking of alumni I wanted to talk, we have Sean from Colgate, class of 2005, on the line. He has a question for our panel. Go ahead, Sean.
Well, I was actually wondering if there are any concrete things that alumni can do in terms of maybe forcing elections for alumni councils or board of trustees at universities to make this change.
Who'd like to take that question up? Dr. Vetter, is that...
Well, I'm not a lawyer. I think the board of the bylaws and the institutional framework in which different institutions operate varies a lot. At some institutions, it's almost impossible. At some state institution, I know you're from Colgate, but some state institutions even have public elections of trustees, believe it or not, for the entire population. Other universities have governors appoint them. Too many private schools do not have an open election process, including Colgate, I might add. And I do think that there ought to be moves made, including legal moves, aggressive legal moves, to force universities and colleges to open up the process of trustee selection. And then once that happens, I think there needs to be concerted efforts, such as we have seen previously, for example, at Dartmouth, to make that happen. But I really should defer to Ann Neal, who knows more about this than I do.
Well, I'm happy to pick up on that. As you've indicated, governors, more often than not across the country, are responsible for appointing trustees to our public colleges and universities, and it's important as taxpayers and parents that we hold our governors accountable for strong appointments. We want them to pick people who understand higher ed, who have a range of experiences, whether it's as parents or as academics or as business people, who can bring an informed lay perspective to our colleges and universities, because that is something that is uniquely American and American higher education. So we want to insist that governors appoint good trustees, and we want to hold them accountable when they do. I think, as Dr. Vetter has also indicated, at a number of private institutions, not a large number, but at a number of private institutions, it is possible for alumni to put up petition candidates. It's possible for them certainly to become engaged in the process of electing alum trustees. I know this is true at Harvard. This is true at Yale to a certain degree, although it's at a different level. It's true at Colgate. So it is possible, and the American Council of Trustees and Alumni is here to assist alums who want to vigorously address these issues through the trustee election process and to make their views known in an effective way to the boards, whether as candidates or in letters to the administrators and the trustees who are already there.
Okay, and I'm going to push my luck maybe a little bit, but I have to ask Dr. Krainak. I don't expect you to speak on behalf of all of Colgate, but at least as one faculty member there on campus for a good long time, do you think it can be done? What's the mood amongst, do you know, amongst administrators, faculty, when annoying alumni like us come up and we want to make changes, or we have a question or we want to challenge, what's the view from the inside? Do you hear anything? Are we pests? Do they want us to go away? Are we somebody that they'd be willing to talk to? Do you have any sort of...
I think there's mixed feelings. I mean, I think the universities are a bit spoiled in the sense that they don't have the same amount of checks and balances or the same system of accountability that a democracy does. And there's a little bit, and we don't even have two parties in the university. So there's always a little bit of a feeling of this doesn't fit with the kind of, you know, the governance structure. But I think people are honest enough to recognize this is a legitimate debate. And therefore, even though we don't necessarily want to hear these criticisms, this is a legitimate and important debate. And alumni are certainly one of the most, if not the most important factor in the checks and balances in the university system. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with an alumni, for example, who gives money to a university to ask, where is my money going? Should I just give to an unrestricted fund or a restricted fund? there's nothing wrong with parents and alumni asking for how budgets are spent. Is it necessary to spend $600,000 on a per year on the student speaking fund? Is it necessary to have many of the offices that I mentioned before? Is it necessary to build a Trudy Fitness Center at Colgate University? So my answer is, sure, it bothers people, but I also think that this is a legitimate debate, and as we continue to push these questions, I think people will recognize that it's a positive and a constructive debate.
Okay, thanks for that. And let's squeeze in another call. We have John calling in from Georgia. Class of 1952. John, what's your question today, sir?
My question is, when I went to school, graduated in 52, professors taught 5 courses one semester and 5 courses the second semester. Now they're pushing for 1 course the first semester and 1 course the second semester, and this is an absolute joke. And they're only working half a year. Is there any change in that trend?
Go ahead, Ann.
Okay, Ann Neal on that. Well, John, that's a very good question, and it's one that trustees are really going to have to tackle head on. I think that this is one of those areas that is very opaque in our colleges and universities. How much do professors teach? But I can tell you, given the data that's out there, it's very clear that over time they've been teaching less, and as a consequence, schools have been hiring instructors instead. In fact, we have a very recent publication, Selling Students Short, which addresses this issue of faculty teaching loads head on. I think that this gets back to Dr. Vetter's point. This gets back to incentives. Professors' incentives today are directed toward research and not teaching. And this is another place where trustees can make a very large difference in rewarding those who are good teachers, in making clear that institutional resources will be used for those who teach more and reach out to students to provide them an excellent education. We've seen at Iowa State, where they have a special program working with individual faculty to gear their compensation to what they do well, whether it's research or whether it's teaching. So you're absolutely right. The teaching loads bears directly on cost. It bears directly on access, because when teachers aren't there and available, students can't get the courses they need. So you've raised a very good point.
Okay, I want to try to squeeze in another call here as time is running short. This has flown by pretty quick. And we have Sarah on the line from Marshall University, class of 2001. Sarah, go ahead with your question. I think it's a very timely and relevant one. What have you got, Sarah?
Well, my question speaks to the quality issue. There has been a phenomenon of sort of free online universities like Khan University, Freethink University, flourishingthroughbusiness.org that are doing, you know, all of these classes that kind of fill in the gaps in like character development and some really nuts and bolts skills that the students aren't learning in college. Is that going to change the paradigm?
Can I take that one? This is Bob Kranek.
Okay, sure, sir. Go ahead.
I think in some areas, in response to Sarah's question, this is Bob Kranek from Colgate speaking, that in many areas this will be a very constructive development. Computer science, natural science, many of the technical subjects, I think online courses will in fact be a valuable challenge and a form of competition to the universities today. However, in the humanities, in philosophy, in political theory, which I teach, our model has always been Socrates as the great teacher. And, of course, we know that Socrates teaches through dialogue, through conversation, through dialectic, through question and answer, through the probing of a student's mind in relationship to the teacher. I don't think that will ever be replaced by online education, and that's where real teaching takes place, in a small classroom in which the great model of Socrates and many of the other teachers have inspired us for centuries. So I would give a mixed answer to your question. I think in some areas it's a great idea, provides useful competition, but in other areas I think the teacher will be, the live teacher with the live student is irreplaceable.
Okay. I want to just finally get to our final polling question. As I know, we've only got a few moments left and we're going to have to roll here in a little bit. To our listeners out there, our final question, and it's a simple one. If you've hung with us this long, we imagine you're very interested in this topic. Would you like to have more information, or would you like to perhaps be involved with us, Alumni to the Rescue? If you want information, dial 1 right now. We'll be more than happy to talk to you, more than happy to tell you what we've got going on. Dial 1 right now if you'd like some more information or you'd like to be involved with Alumni to the Rescue. There were a lot of questions we couldn't get to today. If you're still on the line and you want to ask that question, we will answer it personally. We'll get to you via email after our phone call. Leave your contact information. Well, there's a couple ways we can do this, actually. Leave your contact information through a voicemail after the call. Or else, if that doesn't work for you, alumnitotherescue.com. Feel free to get in touch with us that way, alumnitotherescue.com. What I'd like to do is quickly, since we're running out of time here, our panelists, as you can tell, have a lot of great ideas, and probably an hour wasn't enough to do them justice. I want to go ahead and give everybody a quick moment to maybe make a quick final comment. Anything you'd like to squeeze in that we haven't hit or that you think is important as a parting shot to leave with our listeners? And, Dr. Vetter, I'm going to go ahead and start with you.
Well, this has been a very constructive conversation. Higher education is a valuable good to our society, but until we provide people with more information about the way universities work and we incentivize the faculty and the staff to behave in a way that would be more in the public interest in terms of cutting costs and providing benefits, I think we're going to have some trouble. To me, the solution does largely come from the outside. In some cases, that's state governments and so forth, private philanthropists with lots of money, but mostly it's from the alumni. So I think the alumni play a critical role in the process, and I encourage the people who are listening in this call to get involved with their universities.
Okay, thanks, Dr. Vetter. And Ann Neal from the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, final thoughts?
Sure, I'll second what Dr. Vetter said. Alumni and trustees are an enormous source of financial support for higher education, and I think it's time that our universities realize that they aren't just ATM machines, give us your money, no questions asked, that in fact they are a force for good and for high standards and affordability. And I think we can look and see groups like the Society for the College of William and Mary, which helped return the Red Cross to the chapel and has been working on issues of curricular standards. We can see the alumni at Yale, Harvard, and Columbia who worked for the return of ROTC, who wrote to the trustees and were successful there. We can look at alumni at Yale and Princeton who've recently weighed in about the college selection process there, serving as a voice for good governance. So I think there's lots of very excellent examples of effective alumni groups, and the American Council of Trustees and Alumni is here to help those who would like to reach out in positive ways to their alma maters.
Okay, thank you, Ann. And certainly if you're interested in that, check out the American Council of Trustees and Alumni. And last but not least, Dr. Robert Cranack from Colgate. Your thoughts, please.
My final thought is, we have a great deal at stake with this debate. What is at stake really is the survival of the middle class in America today. I think we acknowledge that the very wealthy are going to be able to take care of themselves, but the middle class feels a great squeeze, and those people who would like to be members of the middle class, the minorities of our society. And if we don't get this problem under control, this will be one of the most crucial ways in which the middle class is going to find itself squeezed, sinking, and feeling a sense of anxiety that it feels in many other areas of American society today. So this is a tremendously important debate, and the survival of the middle class and the aspiring middle class in America is at stake.
Okay, and thank you, Professor, for that. So very interesting today. Just to reiterate, we had almost 1,700 people join this conference call today. We had a number of people we couldn't get to, and we're sorry for that. And remember, if you'd like to ask your question, go ahead and get to us at alumnitotherescue.com, alumnitotherescue.com. We'll answer your questions personally and get back in touch with you. And hey, if you'd like to help us spread the word and host more of these town hall conversations, because hey, it certainly looks like there was a lot of interest here this morning. One, if you'd like us to host more of these and help spread the word, you can donate at our website, alumnitotherescue.com. We've got some interesting news. Your donation actually will be matched by our fantastic coalition members. We have among them the Alexander Hamilton Institute, ACTA, the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, and the Better Colgate. That group has pledged to match your donations. So if this interests you and excites you, get in touch with us at alumnitotherescue.com and donate. And I think we're probably going to have another one or two at least of these conversations. So again, we want to thank our panel so very much for joining us. We want to thank all the people who called in, all of our participants on the survey questions. Really a very constructive conversation. Again, my name is Greg Marag. I've been your host, and we want to thank you so much, and we'll be back in touch with you. And once again, check us out on Facebook, like our Facebook page, and if you'd like to know more, get in touch, talk with us, questions, comments, challenges, go ahead and get to us at www.alumnitotherescue.com. Have a wonderful day, everybody. Thanks again to our panelists. Good day.